Hello, this is Chris Yerkes reading to you from the May 10th edition of the Journal. We'll start with the front page stories. Old water main breaks causes loss of water services by Dominic Stallings. Tuscola lost water Saturday night when an old water main broke at 7:30 p.m. underneath the railroad on Main Street. Water service came back at 11:30 p.m. later that night under a boil order, which was lifted at 3:38 p.m. on Sunday. According to City Administrator Drew Hole, the city found a leak underneath the railroad coming from an old cast iron pipe with no valves. Denny Cruzan, city foreman, said newer water pipes are encased, meaning they are pipes within a pipe, but the older mains that run under the tracks are not. Due to a lack of encasing pipe, the leak could not be repaired. The crew continued to perform a line stop to shut off the pipe that morning. The city had previously installed two other water mains at the Niles and Washington Crossing, so stopping the line would not have impacted water service significantly. Hole said the contractors did everything they could to prevent the pipe from breaking. He said the water main broke because a piece of the contractor's equipment was destroyed while working on the leak. "We had to shut it off and shut off the valve coming into town, or it was going to do it for us," said Hole. After the water service was online, the city issued a citywide boil order. Several businesses had to close or reduce their services over the weekend. Hole said because of the citywide loss of power, water pressure, the city had to test the water twice due to Illinois EPA requirements. The water tests and sampling have to be performed at a certified lab outside of Tuscola and require bacteria to grow on a petri dish. The whole process can take up to 18 hours. Cruzan said the testing is normally constrained to regular business hours, but that the company made an exception to expedite water service to the city. Both tests passed, which allowed Tuscola to lift the boil order on Sunday afternoon. Mayor Dan Cly said there was a lot of good information about boil orders on the city website at tuscola.org. A second article, City Opens Church Time Capsule to Find Waterlogged Papers, by David Porter. A small crowd gathered at Tuscola City Hall Monday evening in anticipation of the opening of a time capsule from the old Presbyterian Church. The copper box was found inside the cornerstone of the building, which had not been used as a church for many years. After serving as a retail outlet under the name Castle Mall, the building was unoccupied when it burned last July 9th. The city acquired the property to ensure its timely demolition in April of this year. The wrecking crew found the time capsule and gave it back to the city. The box was crammed full of old newspapers, including the Tuscola Journal-Republican, the Tuscola Review, and a couple of Chicago newspapers. Most of the papers were from 1902 when the contents were sealed, but the Review was a special edition published in 1899 containing photos and drawings of local homes, businesses, and people. Also in the box were publications from Tuscola High School and several local churches. Unfortunately, the contents were waterlogged. The fragile papers were stuck together. Mayor Dan Kleiss and Treasurer Alta Long spent nearly an hour after the meeting carefully separating pages and spreading them out to dry in an effort to preserve the papers. Judy Langett asked the what the plans are for the cornerstone. She noted that the cornerstone for the old high school, which became the second North Ward grade school, was on display at the festival corner downtown, and she thinks that that would be a good place for the church stone. Following the opening of the time capsule, the City Council continued its meeting, which included approving emergency repairs to a water main and waiving formal bidding for them. Cross Construction did the work. Drew Hull, City Administrator, said he did not know yet what the bill would be. The whole city and some residential customers were without water over the weekend when a water main broke on Main Street, just south of the railroad tracks. After water service was restored, the city was under a boil order. More information can be found on the article titled Old Water Main Breaks Causes Loss of Water Services in this week's journal. Kleiss thanked the community for its patience during the boil order over the weekend. He said there's a lot of good information about boil orders and the city's website at tuscola.org. Also on the city's website is information about emergency notifications, he said. The city now uses a program called HyperReach to alert residents about local emergencies. If residents signed up for the alerts under Code Red system, they will need to sign up again under HyperReach, Kleiss said. On the city's website, click the button that reads Residents and then the button that reads Emergency Notifications. There, residents will find another button that reads HyperReach Douglas County Sign Up. In other business, the City Council swore in members who are re-elected to office. They also approved the consent agenda, which included the Pace for PD 5K and Walk September 30th, outdoor movie nights with street closures June 2nd, July 7th, and August 4th, and the Tuscola GSA Booster Club Pound the Pavement for Pride 5K Color Run Walk on June 10th. They appointed Dalton Donnells, Brian Endres, Rob Hardwick, Bill Hemmer, Bill Schweigart, and Brian Yantis to the Foreign Fire Insurance Board, which Hull said allows the fire department to receive about $14,500 annually from the state for equipment and tools. They approved spending $17,850 with Air One equipment for fire department equipment. They approved an audit engagement letter from LWA, a CPA firm. They approved changes to the city's health insurance plan. They approved a revised proposal for roof repairs to the library with I-57 roofing in the amount of $36,700. They renewed the lease for Gina Romain for the tropical snow stand at the pool, and they approved a revised list of summer employees. The last front page story is the history of Villa Grove alumni reunions by Tony Hooker. In 1904, Theodore Roosevelt was president and the Japanese and the Russians were at war with each other. You could buy a cashmere or worsted suit from a haberdashery on Main Street for about $10. The Villa Grove Gazette, a precursor to the Villa Grove News and the Journal, editorialized about the need for a new school in Villa Grove as the one in Old Town was too crowded for the 300 to 500 students who were expected to attend in the fall. Six passenger trains a day, three headed south and three headed north, left the Villa Grove station. Also in 1904, the Villa Grove School Alumni Association held their first end-of-the-year banquet, an event that has taken place annually ever since, except for the two COVID years of 2020 and 2021. Alumni, as it is known to all, will once again be taking place on May 27th, and according to Pam Sigler, a special recognition will be given to the 100th anniversary of the VGHS Boys Basketball State Championship and to other successful high school teams. Sigler, who's been involved in planning alumni events over 40 years, has seen interest in the events rise and fall over the years. "We used to send out over 1,800 invitations for the event back in the 90s," Sigler said. In 1954, over 400 people returned to Villa Grove to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the event, which included the class of 29, convening for a reunion at the home of Mr. and Mrs. C.A. Riddell, and the class of 34, who celebrated their reunion at the home of Rosanna Montgomery. The banquet held in the old community building went from 6 to 9 and concluded with the election of officers for the Alumni Association, and live music was provided from 9 to 1 a.m. In many ways, the mid-80s were when the event was at its largest and best. Sigler reported that in 1985, over 450 people squeezed into the community building for the banquet and dance. Interest was so strong that there weren't enough folding tables in Villa Grove to accommodate all of the guests, so the Alumni Association borrowed dozens from the University of Illinois, and the strong interest continued into the 90s. Over the course of the last decade of the century, many factors contributed to a loss of interest in the event. Bands had become too expensive for the committee to hire, so a series of DJs were brought in for entertainment. The community building was determined to be unfit and closed, so the banquet was relocated to the school, first in the big gym and last year in the new gym. Because it was at the school, no alcohol could be present, and interest in the dance waned and is no longer offered. In 2004, the 100th anniversary of the event, 285 people attended the banquet, which Villa Grove News noted was one of the biggest crowd in years. Sigler, the Alumni Association president, was presented a bracelet at the event after deciding to relinquish her role as leader. Frances Duncan from VGHS class of 1933 was recognized as the most seasoned graduate in attendance. Which brings us to this year's event. Sigler said she's aiming for 200 attendees, although she estimates they'll probably be closer to 150. She's also adamant about the class of 2023 making every effort to attend. "We're here to honor them," Sigler stated emphatically. "They need to see that they're part of something larger than themselves or their class. There'll be reunions throughout the day. The banquet and the Corner Beehive and the VFW will have live music at the Main Street Plaza starting at 2 p.m. and lasting until the late hours, with all funds raised being donated to the new VG Community Center." Mother's Day Concert at Vault Art Gallery by Kirby Pringle. Just when you thought there were no musical events just for Mother's Day in Tuscola, you'll need to recalibrate your thinking. The swing jazz band from Charleston, We Ain't Misbehaving, performs at 2 p.m. Saturday, May 13th at the Vault Art Gallery in downtown Tuscola. Members of the outfit include Yvonne Larson on vocals, Michael Brown on bass, Sarah Wiseman on accordion, and Karen Hart on vocals. Bob St. Jem is on guitar, while his wife Laura plays violin. We Ain't Misbehaving is an offshoot of another popular Charleston band, the Moondogs. "I had started that band, and it became pretty popular around here," Bob St. Jem said. But then last spring, we decided to go in different directions from rock and blues, and my wife Laura agreed to it, and we left the Moondogs on amicable terms. We're all still friends. The band performs as part of a special Mother's Day event at the Vault Art Gallery. The performance is free to the public, and the public is welcome to attend. Seating will be available and refreshments will be provided. We started playing what I would call gypsy jazz, but we're not limited to anything. We do tango, swing music, samba, a bit of Django Reinhardt, things like that. We've become a world music band. Yvonne has a big voice and can sing anything. Her and Karen Hart sound beautiful together, St. Jem said. We Ain't Misbehavin' performs once or twice a month, and that schedule is fine for St. Jem and the other members. That's plenty for us. We want to keep it fun and not turn this into a job, he said. The direction I'd like to go in is to perform in more upscale places like wineries, art galleries like the Vault, and places like that. The band's last performance at the Vault was indeed a popular affair with a large crowd in attendance. Our network is growing rapidly and become quite popular in the short time we've been together, St. Jem added. We'll move now to the obituaries. Kenneth D. Olson, 76, of Arthur, passed away at home on May 5, 2023. Graveside services will be held at 4 p.m. Tuesday, May 9th at the Arthur Cemetery with Pastor Jill Bunker officiating. Schrader Funeral Home Arthur is assisting the family with arrangements. Cindy K. Kincaid Jones, 64 of Charleston, formerly of Newman, passed away on Sunday, April 30th, 2023 at Hilltop Skilled Nursing and Rehab. A celebration of Cindy's life was held Saturday, May 6th at the Joins Funeral Home in Newman with Pastor Dwayne Piercy officiating. Private burial followed. A visitation was held prior to the service. Memorial donations can be made to help the family with funeral expenses. Ronald Ron Kingerly, a former resident of Belvedere, passed peacefully on Monday, April 17, 2023, in Wisconsin at the age of 87. A private burial service will take place in Belvedere in May. Frances Elaine Franklin, 95, of Champaign, passed away at 10:03 a.m. on Tuesday, April 25, 2023, at Carriage Crossing Senior Living in Champaign. Memorial service will be held at 4 p.m. Saturday, May 13th, at Walnut Grove Christian Church in Arcola. Pastor Aaron Booth will officiate. The Edwards Funeral Home is assisting with arrangements. Jerry D. Wilson, 77, of Villa Grove, passed away on Wednesday, April 26, 2023, at Carl Hospital in Urbana. A celebration of Jerry's life will be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations have been made to an organization of the donor's choice. Jeffrey Allen Jeff Daig, 39, of Champaign, formerly of Arcola, passed away on Saturday, April 29, 2023, at his residence. A celebration of life service was held Saturday, May 6th, at the Edwards Funeral Home in Arcola. Eric Friedman officiated. Visitation was held prior to the service at the funeral home. In lieu of flowers, a benefit fund has been established for Braden at the Philo Exchange Bank in St. Joseph. Checks can be made out to Braden J. Daig Benefit Fund and can be mailed to Philo Exchange Bank, 802 East Warren Street, P.O. Box 590, St. Joseph, Illinois. Jean Donalds Lynch, 89, of Jacksonville, North Carolina, passed away at 2:01 p.m. Thursday, April 27th at her home. Graveside services were held on May 1st at Onslow Memorial Park in Jacksonville, coordinated by Jones Funeral Home in Jacksonville. Wilfred Charles Stark, 93, of Arcola, passed away surrounded by family at 12 noon on Tuesday, May 2nd, 2023, at Carriage Crossing in Arcola. Visitation was held Saturday, May 6th at the Edwards Funeral Home, Arcola. Funeral services were held Sunday, May 7th at the funeral home. Pastor Brent Budd officiated. Burial with military rites conducted by the Arcola Honor Guard was in the Arcola Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials have been made to the Arcola First Christian Church, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, or donor's choice. Rosemary Kneller, 81, of Sullivan, formerly of Shelbyville, passed away at 2:29 p.m. Monday, May 1st, 2023, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. Funeral services were held Saturday, May 6th in Howe and Yaki Funeral Home, Shelbyville. Visitation was Saturday in the funeral home. Memorials will be given to Make-A-Wish Foundation or the National Kidney Foundation. Other local events, Alpaca Shearing Bench Dedication at Amish Center. Two noteworthy events will be taking place during the Sheep to Yarn to Quilts program Saturday, May 13th at the Illinois Amish Heritage Center. One is the shearing of alpacas, and the other is a special bench dedication honoring Fred Bumpus, who worked at the First National Bank in Arcola for 27 years, where he managed farm accounts. 10 members of his family are expected to be at the ceremony, along with longtime friend, 99-year-old Evelyn Brandt, who donated the funds for the bench. Brandt owns Brandt Industries in Springfield and was once neighbors with the Bumpus family. Since both families were in farm-related businesses, they became fast friends, she said. Bumpus worked for the Marine Bank, now Chase Bank, before moving to Arcola. Brandt said she and the Bumpuses had their first two houses in the Sherwood subdivision in Springfield. While Bumpus was a banker, his relationship with farm managers was helpful to Brandt's business, and she has remembered his kindness with donations of four benches and a discovery garden at the Amish Center. Wilmer Otto, representing the Amish Center, said Bumpus was a beloved banker and community leader in Arcola for many years. He was a trustee of the Arcola Foundation. He was a key figure in developing the Arcola Industrial Park, attracting many new businesses to Arcola. He passed away on December 26, 2012, after a courageous battle with pulmonary fibrosis. The alpacas are owned by Levi and Gloria Yoder, who acquired them from Levi's niece in Goshen, Indiana. Otto said they are similar to the South American llamas and are quite sociable with people. They will be shorn from 10 a.m. till 12 noon, May 13th, but will be available to greet visitors throughout the day. The bench dedication takes place at 12 noon with a ribbon-cutting ceremony. Other events happening at the IAHC campus include sheep shearing, wool spinning, loom weaving, petting zoo, and other pioneer activities. And because May is Service Appreciation Month, there's an article, U.S. Army Specialist 4th Class John Edwin Mitchell, Special Service, Green Beret, by Carolyn Cloyd. John Mitchell always wanted to be a pilot, just like his father. One cherished family photo taken on the porch of his grandmother's house in Arcola reveals an unhappy young John dressed and ready to pilot his bicycle with his leather gloves and goggles pushed back on his head, upset because his mother refused to let him wear goggles in the photograph. Flying was a lifelong dream, deferred by responsibilities, but once he finished a second tour in Vietnam in early January 1967, John Mitchell planned to make it a reality. John Edwin Mitchell's family ties to Arcola and Douglas County go back several generations. John was born to John Samuel and Nellie Louie Mitchell, née Black, on May 31, 1935, his maternal grandmother's home in Arcola. The house was then listed with a Pine Street address, but is now 229 East Madison Street. John Samuel Mitchell was born in Wautoma, Oklahoma in 1908, and Nellie was born near Arcola in 1916. An article in the Arcola Record Herald reported that John Samuel Mitchell and Nellie Black were married at 8 p.m. on Saturday, October 3, 1929, in Charleston. Nellie Black was a junior at Arcola High School, and John Samuel Mitchell had been a resident of camp for about a year and was employed by the Farm Bureau in Tuscola. Nellie Black Mitchell was the daughter of Leroy Roy Black and Catherine Burt Black of Arcola. Roy Black was born in Wayne County in 1886 and moved with his parents and siblings to Arcola when he was about 7 years old. In late November 1925, he became desperately ill and was taken to the hospital in Mattoon, where doctors wanted to perform surgery, but he refused. He passed away on December 21, 1925, at the age of 39, leaving his wife and four children. At the time of his death, he was an alderman for the city of Arcola and had been employed as an express agent for the Illinois Central Railroad for several years. Catherine Burt Black was born in Arcola in 1886 to James and Mary Powden Burt. James was born in Paris but moved to the Oakland area about the age of 12, where he lived the rest of his life. Mary Burt was born in Louisiana in 1857 and moved to Arcola with her parents when she was 2 years old. Catherine Burt married Leroy Roy Black in Douglas County on October 16, 1906. When Catherine's husband died in 1925, leaving her to support four children, she took on the job as express agent, a position she held for 19 years. Catherine lived and raised her four children in Arcola at the house 229 East Madison Street. Shortly after their marriage, John Samuel and Nellie Black moved to Arcola, where they lived off and on for a decade. They also lived in Pisodum, where John was the proprietor of an automotive garage. They had four children, Billy, John, Edwin, Beverly, and Justice, and Joyce. Billy was delivered by Arcola's Dr. Omar Barnes, and John and Joyce were delivered by Arcola's Dr. E.S. Allen. By 1940, the family seemed to have settled in Pisodum. John Samuel was an avid flyer, and around 1944, he purchased a 30-horsepower Porterfield airplane. According to his daughter, Joyce Zender, her father was a fun-loving guy. He would take the boys up in the plane and he would fly over their house, which was located right off the highway and just over the railroad tracks in Pisodum, and tip the wings as if he was saying hello. Around 6:30 p.m. in the evening of August 12, 1945, just after flying over his house and tipping his wings to his children playing in the yard, John Samuel's plane crashed into a cornfield east of Route 45 on the south edge of Pisodum. John received multiple injuries and was rushed to a hospital in Champaign, where he passed away. He was just 37 years old. Nellie remarried about a year later to a farmer from Newman, but the marriage did not last. She moved the family back to Pasoda, where she purchased a grocery store. Billy and John Mitchell attended Wentworth Millie Academy and College in Lexington, Missouri. Around 1950, the family moved to Houston and eventually to Las Vegas. John Edwin Mitchell attended high school in Las Vegas, where he met his future wife, Melvadina Sweeney. They married shortly before John was to graduate from high school. They had three children, two girls and a boy. John became the transportation manager for Titanium Metals in Henderson, Nevada, but the marriage did not last, and the couple eventually divorced. John's oldest child, daughter named Debbie Hill, recalls what a vibrant man her father was, saying that he could draw and loved to play chess, and vividly remembers her father teaching her to play chess when she was just 5 years old. Her father could also play the guitar and was a good singer, and she remembers her parents gathering with friends to play and sing. Hill said her father, who had pinto horses when he was young, loved to ride and had all the confidence in someone's saddle, is now a passion she shares. In 1962, John Mitchell joined the U.S. Army and at the age of 27 reported to Fort Bragg, North Carolina for special forces training in Columbus, Georgia, and for more intensive training at Fort Knox, Kentucky. He was a specialist in radio and photography. Pointing out that while becoming a Green Beret is quite an accomplishment for anyone, Hill explained that it was just a little bit more so for her father. "My dad was in his late 20s when he joined," said Hill. "In Dad's case, he was competing against much younger men just out of high school. He was a father with three children, but he made the cut and won his 3 out of 100 that qualified to become a Green Beret. He was so proud. But determination and experience just seemed to be part and parcel of the man he was." His sister, Joyce Mitchell Zender, remembers how he would go full tilt at anything he put his mind to, how he would get out books and study anything he wanted to learn, and he'd know all about it. The thought was echoed by his daughter. "My dad was very intelligent, and I don't just say that because he was my dad," said Hill. "If he was going to do something, and I mean no matter what it was, he set out to be the best at it. He researched the things that interested him." Separations were hard for his family. His daughter said he was away a lot after he joined the Army, but when he had a chance to leave, he spent it with always calling them his babies, and he would always come to tell them goodbye right before he left when his leave was over, no matter what time it was. John Mitchell was assigned to the 5th Special Services Group Airborne and served 2 tours of duty in Vietnam. On his first tour in 1965, John was injured when he was shot down while parachuting from a crippled helicopter near the Cambodian border, and both of his legs were broken. John was home on a 2-month leave to allow him to fully recuperate prior to leaving on his second tour of duty to Vietnam, which began on January 30, 1966. In early November, Specialist 4th Class John Mitchell found himself in the Central Highlands of Vietnam, serving as a radio telephone operator with Task Force Prong under the command of Dr. Colonel Eleazar Parmley, 4th, Task Force Prong. Consisted of 3 companies of Montagnards, the indigenous people of the Central Highlands, supported by U.S. Special Forces advisors. According to Lieutenant Colonel Parmley, they were on a mission to protect the left flank of the 4th United States Infantry Division that was making a massive attack, an action called the Operation Paul Revere the 4th. The task force had been operating for 3 days on the Ho Chi Minh Trail in a place called Plit Trap Valley. On November 10, 1966, Task Force Prong was attacked by the NVA, the North Vietnamese Army 6th Battalion. In a vignette about the Plait Trap Valley ambush in the book West to Cambodia, the author, S.L.A. Marshall, reveals that shortly before the ambush, Parmley's group halted near a stream and Parmley sat talking to John Mitchell, who'd been designated acting sergeant, while Mitchell showed him a snapshot of his children. Parmley questioned why Mitchell had come to the operation when he did not have to, and Mitchell said that he'd been doing so much sitting in my can in bunkers that it wanted to take part at least one mission before he went home. Shortly after starting off again, the task force was ambushed, resulting in several casualties, including Specialist 4th Class Mitchell, who was shot through the left shoulder. Parmley called in more ground troops and called in a favor for an old West Point classmate for air support. As the fighting continued, Mitchell was hit in the chest by a grenade fragment, but he carried on. Parmley made the decision to make a move and sent a platoon led by Sergeant Carlos Caro ahead to try to secure a stream crossing, and because he trusted Specialist 4th Class Mitchell's judgment more than any of his other radio telephone operators, he asked him if he would go ahead and signal him when they got there. Marshall said Mitchell simply nodded and noted that he was too weak to carry the radio, someone else had to carry it for him. Just 40 meters down the trail, the platoon encountered automatic gunfire. John Mitchell was hit in the chest. When the platoon retreated back to Parmley, Mitchell was not with them. Sergeant Carroll formed a squad to retrieve him, and for 4 minutes, while under machine gun fire, Carroll attempted mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on Mitchell, but it was too late. Included in Marshall's book is a photo of John Mitchell taken during the skirmish with a caption that notes that 1 hour after the photo was taken, Mitchell was killed in action. and there's an accompanying article in the Arcola Record Herald announcing the death of John Mitchell. Sergeant John E. Mitchell of Las Vegas, Nevada, formerly of Arcola, was killed in action in Vietnam November 10th, according to a report received here this week. His mother, Mrs. Nellie Black Mitchell of Las Vegas, received a letter from Sergeant Mitchell dated November 7th in which he told her, "I won't be long now." He was slated to return to the United States in January. Sergeant Mitchell, a member of the Green Berets Special Forces paratroopers, was fatally wounded and died in the Central Highlands of Vietnam while on his second tour of duty in the war. He'd been injured in 1965 when shot down while perishing on the border, on the ground near the Cambodian border, it is reported. Sergeant Mitchell was buried with full military honors from the Nellis Air Force Base Chapel in Las Vegas. He was born and reared in Arcola, son of Mr. and Mrs. John Mitchell, moving from Arcola area about 15 years ago. He is survived by his mother, one brother, Sergeant Billy Mitchell, who suffered permanent injuries while serving in Vietnam in 1964, two sisters, Beverly Gray of Arleta, California, and Mrs. Joyce Reber of Las Vegas, Nevada, and three children, Debbie, Kathy, and Skipper, all of Las Vegas. He also leaves a great-aunt, Mrs. Grace Warner of Arcola, two uncles, Wilburn Black of Kankakee, Illinois, and Sergeant Major Richard L. Black of Hawaii, and his grandmother, Mrs. Catherine Land of Houston, Texas, and Mrs. Martha Mitchell of El Dorado, Illinois. There's another article. Hughes joins First Mid. First Mid Trust Bank and Trust welcomed Laura Hughes as their new Chief Marketing and Deposit Officer. Hughes will be responsible for leading First Mid's marketing and deposit strategy, as well as overseeing its performance, culture, and overall customer experience. With over 20 years of marketing and customer-focused experience in the banking and insurance industries, Hughes brings a wealth of knowledge and expertise to her new role. She most recently served as Chief Marketing Officer at HTLF, Heartland Financial Incorporated, which is a $20 billion bank headquartered in Denver, Colorado. Prior to that, she held executive positions as digital marketing leader for the commercial banking at J.P. Morgan Chase and head of marketing for the Federal Reserve's Bank Financial Services Division. "We're thrilled to have Laura join our executive team," says Joe Dively, chairman and chief executive officer at First Mid. "I am confident she'll have a direct impact on our digital strategy and execution. Given the importance of deposits in today's environment, we felt it was crucial to align our digital strategy, deposit team, and marketing team. I am excited to see the impact Laura makes on our company as we embrace the opportunities and challenges that our industry currently faces. I'm delighted and honored to join the strong leadership team at First Mid," says Hughes. "I look forward to leveraging my experience and expertise to help drive the bank's growth and, in collaboration with our dedicated employees, provide exceptional experiences to our customers while also generating profitable results for our shareholders." Hughes is a graduate of Northern Illinois University and holds a Master of Business Administration from Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. She dedicates her time and talents to numerous volunteer organizations. Hughes has contributed her expertise as a board member for both the National Park Service Heritage Corridor and her local chapter of Chamber of Commerce. She's also a devoted volunteer for the U.S. Marine Corps' Toy for Tots program. And one last article, Skin Cancer Awareness Month. Skin cancer is the most common cancer in the world, but there's good news. It's also the cancer you can see on your body. By learning to recognize the warning signs of the disease, you can identify suspicious spots before they become dangerous. Most skin cancers are highly treatable when diagnosed at an early stage, but if left to grow, they can become disfiguring or even deadly. This is why early detection of skin cancer is so important. It can save your life or the life of a loved one. May is Skin Cancer Awareness Month. The Skin Cancer Foundation recommends you perform a head-to-toe self-exam every month to look for potential skin cancers. Some things to look for include a growth that changes in size, thickness, color, or texture. Skin cancers can appear pearly, transparent, tan, brown, black, or multicolored. You should also pay attention to any sore that doesn't heal. Or it continues to itch, hurt, or crust, or is slow to heal. The ugly duckling rule is something else to keep in mind during a self-exam. The rule is based on the concept that normal moles on the body resemble each other, while melanoma, a dangerous form of skin cancer, can stand out like an ugly duckling. These lesions can be larger, smaller, lighter, or darker in contrast to surrounding moles. Isolated lesions without surrounding moles for comparison are also considered ugly duckling. Since all skin cancers present differently, the most important thing is to be looked at for anything new or changing as unusual. If you spot anything suspicious during your self-exam, you should make an appointment with a dermatologist right away. You can find out more information on how to perform a skin exam, prepare for an annual exam on skincancer.org. And that is all we have time for this week. This is Chris Yerkes saying goodbye and see you next week.